Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live in the green space. And when we're live in the green space, you can watch as well as listen to the show. We stream live video at WNYC.org or the WNYC Facebook page. With me now, playwright Tony Kushner and actor Nikki James. Tony, go ahead. And as they applaud each other, which you can't see on your radios, Tony, if you don't know, is best known for Angels in America, I guess, but has also written other great plays and screenplays, Caroline or Change, Homebody Kabul, The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures, and more on stage and screenplays for the 2012 film Lincoln and Steven Spielberg's Munich. He was awarded a National Medal of Arts by President Obama. What brings Tony here today is the new version of his 1985 play, A Bright Room Called Day, at the Public Theater, just extended through December 22nd, directed by the Public's artistic director, Oscar Eustace. I was lucky enough to see it on Saturday night. Set in Nazi Germany, Reagan's America, and today, it examines political history, ambivalence and paralysis in the face of evil, and even manages to be funny around the edges of some of the weightiest themes imaginable. Tony himself becomes a character in the play as he thinks out loud about how to revise the play with all this history in the context of Trumpism. Nikki James plays the lead character, Agnes. You may have seen her in her Tony Award-winning role in Book of Mormon. I last saw her in, and she was last here for, her starring role in the Shakespeare in the Park production of Twelfth Night 2 summers ago. Green Space, please welcome Tony Kushner and Nikki James. Again, but you deserved it. This was your first produced play, Tony, wasn't it?
Yes, my first play.
Where were you then in 1985, and what was the original inspiration for this play?
I was in New York, and the original inspiration was Reagan. I just graduated from NYU graduate directing program, and Reagan had just been reelected when I started working on the play. And I wanted to examine the uncomfortable sensation that I was having, that a lot of people were having, that there was something profoundly dangerous going on. I mean, beyond the you know, presence of a right-wing president in the Oval Office, that something was really changing fundamentally in American politics. And I was thinking a lot about Hitler, and I felt sort of embarrassed about that and conflicted about it, but it wouldn't go away, so I decided to write a play that examined it.
And Oscar Eustace's note in the playbill says, "Warnings that seemed apocalyptic in 1985 now look remarkably prescient." What did you feel then that you were warning of, especially as people look back at those days with, I think, a gauzy lens right now?
I mean, I wasn't really clear about it back then, and I think that there was a modern character. Most of the scenes take place in Weimar Germany in 1932 and 1933, at the very end of the Republic and the beginnings, the very rapid coalescing of the fascist regime of the Reich.
And by the way, it's one of the great things about the play, if people get to see it, that just through the timeline that gets presented, you're really representing how quickly Weimar Germany collapsed into fascist Nazi Germany with a sequence of events over barely 6 months in 1932 and 33.
Yeah, it's terrifying. I don't think that there's a direct analogy, and I think that's probably one of the things that tripped me up back in 84, 85 when I was writing it. I'd say now that what I was onto, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and a lot of my plays I think address it, is that any ideology that teaches that government is an evil is absolutely, I think, inarguably anti-democratic, because government is the political incarnation of the demos, of the people in a democracy. And it took a while for this, I think, to become really clear. But Reaganism and its assault on the federal government and on government itself, you know, government is not the solution, it's the problem. With all of its sort of racist dog whistles, you know, him announcing his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and so on, when he first ran in 1980. That blend of racism and demagoguery and an ideology of anti-politics and anti-government is clearly what created a stage for the arrival of Trump and for the possibility, if you replace democracy, you're either going to replace it, I think, with some form of totalitarianism or with anarchy. And I think that anarchy is basically just a little sort of waiting room before you arrive either at some new form of democracy or fascism. Mm.
Before we bring Nikki in, some will say that as bad as many people here today think Trump is and Reagan was, comparisons to Hitler are almost always overwrought and often inappropriate to the scale of the Nazis' horrors. I was reading old clips to, you know, study up for this. Reviews in the 80s, one of them that I saw said that fairly prominently. How would you describe the point of the juxtaposition in the 80s version of the play and today with the 30s?
I think that one of the points is that fascism in Germany, in mid-century Germany, was a successful accomplishment of the German political right. That they own that in the same way that I think the left has to own Stalinism. And it's an event that occurred on a continuum. Many of the politics that led directly to what I call the Hitler mistake, the moment when the German right, the Catholic right, and in Germany, the big business in Germany, decided that they could sort of control a psychopath if they put him in the seat of power, is identical to what's happening now. Mm-hmm. You read, there was an op-ed piece in the Times by the editor-in-chief of the Washington Examiner, who basically sounds like one of those people. And, you know, the idea is, well, we'll handle him. Don't worry about it. And, of course, you can't, and it's just a really sort of manifestly stupid and terrible idea to put a nut in the Oval Office, and that's exactly what the Republican Party has done. I mean, a borderline psychotic, narcissistic character disorder like Donald Trump should not be allowed. I loved reading the articles of impeachment, and that last little tagline on the end of each article, he's disqualified or something from holding any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. It's like the only one of those words that he would actually be able to pronounce is the last one, and that would be the one that upsets him. Honor and trust, of course, are, you know, what he wipes his... Never mind.
I happen to have the articles of impeachment right here.
There you go.
Because I carry them around with me in my line of work. And you're right. The very end of it says, President Trump thus warrants impeachment and trial, removal from office, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
Well, it works for me.
Right. When we don't have to get into a lesson on the emoluments clause. Nikki James, your character is a study, I would call it, in fear and paralysis. Mm. Can you introduce our audience to Agnes Egling?
Sure. Agnes Egling is a young actress. She's working in the studio system. She has a collection of these just dynamic friends, and each of her friends in their own right is much more politically active and shiny and fabulous than she is, and she lives in this world where she sort of creates a world where she gets to live in awe of people she admires, and that feels very safe and cozy and lovely. And she has this belief that there's a sense that she has this belief if she's surrounded by these incredible people, she's also doing something good with her life by giving them the floor and showing a mirror up, bringing a mirror up to them. What happens is each of them over the course of the play decides that it is untenable to stay in the Republic, and they leave, and her fear, her anxiety makes it impossible for her to move, literally move, and she stays, and she feels both betrayed and disappointed in herself, her inability to sort of rise to the occasion. And I was talking with a friend, and we were talking about, you know, sort of fight or flight, and there's this the third one, which is freeze, and that's what she does. Some people fight, some people flee, and she froze in space. And I think it's just like a very sad tale of what inaction and how that can eat away at somewhat a good person's soul. By the end, she's really very much a shell of herself, and we get the sense that she probably doesn't survive. Definitely her spirit doesn't survive.
And one of the most chilling scenes in the play, and maybe in any play, is when the devil himself actually appears as a character. And the other people in your friend's group are freaked out, but your character is strangely drawn to his power.
Yeah.
Can you describe that scene and what Agnes is feeling?
She doesn't speak. He enters the room, and he tells his life story, and it's so beautifully written. It's epic and terrifying each night. I don't have to act. I just sit and watch, and the emotions sort of flood over you. And at the end, each of her friends has sort of engaged with him, either jokingly or, you know, they have a relationship. And she, as he's about to leave, she stops him and she welcomes him to Germany. And she says, "Thank you for coming." I think what happens is she, there's something that draws her into him. And in my, you know, interpretation, that's the moment when she starts, her soul starts sort of unraveling.
And what is that supposed to represent in the wider world, besides this one conflicted individual?
We should ask Tony what he, I mean, I know what I think, but what do you think, Tony?
Oh, gosh. Nothing represents anything. It's not an allegory. But, I don't know. I mean, I feel that there's relief when he appears, because the play in scenes that lead up to it, she and other friends of hers have played around with the question of what evil is, and if evil is just a political phenomenon, or if there's something more. There's a sort of a metaphysics that's hanging uneasily around the edges of the play, and the arrival of the devil gives you an explanation for why suddenly everything has turned so. Mm. Terrible. That relief, I think, can also take the form of a degree of accommodation. And I think we're watching, you know, we're fighting very hard. It's going to be an interesting couple of weeks, because now, in addition to announcing the impeachment, the Democrats are going to be letting Trump have the North America Canada deal and mm-hmm. the military bill and maybe the drug price, the pharmaceutical reduction price reduction bill. I mean, he won't sign that, and I don't understand how any Republican can sign up. But anyway, whatever. But it's going to be interesting. I mean, there's a way in which, you know, part of the response of sane, decent people to Trump is, you know, this is not normal. Don't let this become an acceptable. I was just in London working on another show. I was there several months ago when Boris Johnson had just become prime minister. And, you know, people were just, the BBC guys, the sort of British guys, were, you know, just laughing their heads off about it. It was the most ridiculous thing. And then, of course, he immediately stumbled and bumbled around. 5 months later, I go back, and they're talking about him like he's an elder statesman of some sort. And it's
normalizing.
It's very quickly normalized this aberrant human being and this aberrant politics that he's, you know, foisting on. And it's going to destroy the UK.
And the idea that there's a relief, there's something to giving a name to the feeling that you have, having a it just confirms this question that she's having, and somehow it feels comforting and terrifying all at the same time, and things go quickly badly after that.
And I will say that Tony put the devil in your play, and he's cast as an old white male played by Mark Margolis, who was pretty devilish as Tio in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. That was good casting. And Nikki, Estelle Parsons is in this play at 92, and she's amazing.
Yes.
I could ask the playwright, but will you describe Estelle's character and what she means to yours?
Estelle is an unaccountable, that's the word we use. She is an old lady who appears in my apartment in the middle of the night when I'm having trouble sleeping. And there's a sense of her being a real person and also a ghost, possibly of the past, but probably of the future. And we don't spend a lot of time, Estelle especially and me, giving her a definition, trying to define whatever this is. What's really important is it's the relationship between these two women. Agnes goes from a bit of pity towards her, this old, hungry woman, and then there's a point where she thinks, well, maybe I can befriend her, and eventually she realizes that this woman is trying to take something from her, take her home, her sanctuary. And Estelle, who is, you know, one of the best actors I've ever had the opportunity to work with, and also at 92, one of the strongest humans, is been a joy and just a pleasure to work with, and also totally terrifying. It probably took me 2 weeks to say anything to her that wasn't scripted. She would come into a room and I would shirk off into a corner, and I think it works for the play, actually, my fear of Estelle both on and off stage.
That's hilarious. And Tony, you yourself are a character in the play, and you're very lovable and funny and introspective as portrayed. And on one level, you seem to look back critically on this first real play of yours. I know many artists cringe thinking of their early work, but what was your relationship with this play in real life?
Yeah, the thing that Wallace Stevens said, it's something about the products of one's youth give one the creeps. It's, you know, there have always been things in Bright Room that I'm very, very proud of. I think when you listen to the play now, you sort of, I can see, like in the first few scenes, they're somewhat timid. And scene by scene by scene, I think I began to figure out how to do this thing. I mean, it really was my first serious attempt to write a play. And so it's sort of, I'm intrigued by that. I don't know that anybody else would be, but I'm intrigued by it. I've always felt that it works. It's always been done on college campuses, even though professional theaters have largely avoided it. And I knew that this modern day character, Zilla, didn't work in some way, and then I needed to sort of try and figure out why she was there in the first place.
This is sort of your alter ego in the play,
right?
Well,
there are two Zillas. One is spelled with a Z and one with an X. I have no idea why I did that, and I really regret it, because you never know who you're talking about when you're directing it. The Zilla with an X, the original one was Zilla with a Z, and that's a woman played by Crystal Lucas-Perry, who's just this phenomenal actress, who I saw in Ain't No Mo at the Public earlier this year, and sort of ambushed her in the lobby and said, please be in my play. And to my great shock, she said yes. And then Jonathan Hadary, an actor I've worked with forever and who's a national treasure, is playing Zilla with an X.
Which is you.
Which is basic. Well, sort of. You never hear his name.
Yeah, okay.
But I guess he is. He does say that he wrote the play, so I guess it's me. I won't be coy about it. Sure, why not? You know, and I wanted to grapple with what I think there was something that I didn't trust about theater and about the dramatic form. I've always had an ambivalent relationship to it. The power of theater is a very indirect power. You can't really, when you said earlier, you know, what does it stand for? I mean, it's not ever a clear thing. It's always somewhat vague, and you have to embrace the vagueness and the irresponsibility of it, I think, in order to access the power of it. And I'm a pretty political person, and it's a different kind of power than activism. And I've always had a kind of vexed relationship with it.
And I think it's not too much of a spoiler to say that the play, and very explicitly at the end of the play, is a call to action.
It's working with Oscar Eustace, who directed it originally in the first professional production I ever had at the Eureka Theater in San Francisco in 87, I think. And Oscar and I have worked as a playwright and dramaturg ever since. And we struggled with it. But yeah, the last scene, which you had to learn like 800 versions of,
yes,
that scene.
Yes.
As I
the rewrites, I think it was evolving. It was discovering itself. Each time we would do it, it would become clearer to Tony and Oscar, but also to Crystal and I, what we were really trying to do and say with this epilogue. And also, I think there's this idea, this switch where Agnes, this person who has we've talked a whole play about she can't move, she can't act, she's paralyzed, she's a possum, whatever. And I become increasingly more covered in robes and bigger and stretchier robes. Eventually she says, you know, you're here watching me wondering why I didn't do what I should have done, and I'm turning it back on you and saying, you act. Yeah. You move.
Get out
I
there.
I mean, the,
and
the thing that I had to ask myself finally, the sort of the big eureka moment, was I had a woman in 1980 who was who became, as the play went on, increasingly obsessed with the main character in the Berlin side. And there was a moment that I had written in 1984 where she sort of, they kind of are aware of each other very briefly. And then there was another ending to the play, but they never had a scene together. And that became clearly what the play wanted, was to take these two people who couldn't have a conversation and put them, and it took a long time. It was weird because I don't know how somebody from 1984 in Brooklyn and 1932 in Berlin I don't write that kind. I'm a narrative realist dramatist, and I don't know how to do that. And it took a long time to figure it out. But I will say I was very smart in that we cast two of the most extraordinary actors on the planet, and they really made the play take the shape that it took.
A Bright Room Called Day is at the Public Theater through December 22nd. Please thank Tony Kushner and Nikki James. Thank you all, Green Space audience, for coming out today. Thanks to everyone for listening. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.